We have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, local writers and activists here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's news. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, and welcome back to both of us, I guess.
Yes.
Yeah.
I was careful to take the bus before the bus that I'm supposed to, well, the bus before the bus before the bus that I'm supposed to take to get here.
That's a very popular children's book.
The bus before the bus you're supposed to take.
Yes. So,
it goes along.
Yeah, it was just one of those days.
Yeah.
The stars were in alignment, unfortunately, against us. So, and speaking of which, continuing on into the news of 2020, the stars aligning against us, it appears actually there was some good movement this week, starting with city council.
Well, this week and the week before that we missed talking about last week, I want to first mention the ban on winter evictions, which passed not this past week, but the week before. The council gave its final approval to that ban, and they had six amendments. The most important, four of them were quite important and changed the bill considerably. First, Andrew Lewis, who is the representative in my district, proposed a rent assistance fund for landlords who are having trouble with their cash flow. City doesn't have any money for that fund. But they may decide to fund it in the next budget appropriations. So that fund wouldn't go into effect until at least 2021. Now, the second amendment I want to talk about is one by Alex Peterson, the representative for District 4. He proposed that small landlords be exempted from the ban on winter evictions. Of course, there are many landlords that will buy a building that has fewer than four apartments, four rental units in it, and they'll set up a special LLC for that, and they own other buildings too. So they're really not small landlords. They could get around the winter eviction ban by doing that. So that was one of the objections, yet that passed by a 4-3 margin in the city council. Now, the other two amendments I want to talk about is were proposed by Dan Strauss. He's the representative for District 6, which is Seattle north of the Ship Canal on the west side of the city, including Ballard. One of his amendments was to narrow the window for the ban from November 1st through March 31st, to narrow it down to December 1st through the end of February. And he claimed that that then puts it in line with eviction reform laws passed by the state legislature, which allows judges to impose a 90-day payment period in the case of evictions. So they could do that from December 1st through the end of February, and that would comply with state law, and so it would survive a legal challenge in the courts. But again, that passed by a 4-3 margin with Shama Sawant, Tammy Morales, and Lisa Herbold voting no on it.
Yeah, the problem with that is that Seattle is perfectly capable of having winter weather in November or March, or April for that matter.
Yes.
And, that sort of defeats the purpose of the bill.
Yeah, it really narrowed the bill quite a bit. And then the other amendment that Dan Strauss proposed was restricting the defense because tenants have to claim this defense when they're in court for an eviction. This Strauss proposed limiting it to tenants that make 100% of the area median income or less. And the objections to that amendment, I think, are pretty strong. It sets up a means testing, and it sets up another barrier for tenants. Not only do they now have to claim the defense in court, they also have to bring proof of their income with them if they want to claim this as a defense, and that just adds another barrier. And yet this also passed by a 4-3 vote with Shama Sawant, Tammy Morales, and Teresa Mosqueda voting no. So the winter evictions ban didn't pass. It does provide some protections, but again, those protections have been limited quite a bit by these amendments.
Yeah. Although I would point out that both with that and the transitional encampment bill, those were originally proposed by Sawant, which should put a lie to the fact, the idea that she can't work with colleagues.
Yeah. Now, let's talk a little bit about that homelessness encampments bill.
Sure.
The current law is set to expire at the end of March. this new bill replaces that one. The council had approved $2.6 million, an additional $2.6 million for homeless encampments in the budget for this year, with the understanding that this law would be changed to allow at least a few more encampments. Sawant proposed a bill, and her bill sought to lift the camps, the number of camps, from three. There are currently eight in the city, but three are what the law talks about, to an upper limit of 40 encampments. But of course, the city council's $2.6 million is expected to be enough to pay for only maybe two or three new encampments over the eight that exist right now. Now, the bill will also consolidate the permitting process into one interim use permit, good for 1 year, with an unlimited number of renewals as long as the encampment complies with the city's laws and Human Services Department's requirements. Yeah. And the camps will no longer be forced to move every 2 years, which I think is very important. Also, encampments can now be located in residential areas. Again, that vastly expands the amount of property that can be considered for homeless encampments. The bill passed 6-1 on Tuesday, with Alex Peterson the only no vote, after Shama Sawant called him out for his multiple abstentions, when in fact she thinks he really wants to vote no. He just doesn't want to take credit for having voted no.
Right.
Yeah. So in this case, he did actually come out and vote no.
So my concern with both of those bills, of course, and the encampment bill, because it passed 6-1, it's veto-proof. Mm-hmm. But Durkin could veto the other one.
She has
certainly set the precedent that if she doesn't want to spend that money there, she wants to spend it on one of her pet projects, she will. And so the city council has also got to oversee that.
Yeah. On the other hand, Mayor Durkin is expected to sign the bill and then brag about it, as she's been busy taking credit recently for the success of tiny house villages in transitioning people off the street and into permanent housing. But as you pointed out, Jav, in the budget this last year, Durkin proposed more money for the navigation team to sweep homeless encampments, but she didn't offer a whole lot of additional funding for new encampments or tiny house villages. It was really the city council members like Sawant and Mosqueda who proposed bills that would increase funding for new encampments and new tiny house villages, and they really fought for that. It was not Mayor Durkin, although I think we can expect Mayor Durkin to take credit for this.
Oh, I'm sure she will.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of the navigation teams, Erica Barnett had an article this week about how the, I believe, the lead person in the navigation team was caught this week having several pieces, large parcels of garbage picked up at her house by the navigation team organization, the sub-organization that deals with garbage specifically.
Yeah, the lead person that you're talking about is someone who is an employee of the Seattle Police Department, asking the navigation team cleanup crew to come and just pick up some large items from their house on the way to a job site where they were expected to clean up trash. And yeah, that's an inappropriate use of city resources for personal gain.
And it underscores the cultural problems within both SPD and HSD regarding how they view and treat homelessness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that is an issue, too.
So, yeah, it just begs the question of, so is that an item that then the cost of that falls under SPD police costs, or is that under housing
costs?
Well,
that person should be reimbursing the city for the cost of picking up their personal items. Because, or the rest of us, we have to call somebody to come and pick up large items and take them away.
Yeah.
And that cost should not be borne by the taxpayers. And it is a direct abuse of their position in that role. I think the question is, does that person need to be replaced by somebody who knows the difference between abusing their position as head of the navigation team to ask their co-workers to use city resources to benefit them personally? I think that's the question we should be asking.
All right. Other developments on city council or do we move on to fingerprinting and speaking of homeless?
Yeah. Erica Barnett reported in her blog, The C is for Crank, this week, which I recommend to people.
Absolutely.
Yeah, she's broken a lot of great stories in the last several years.
Yeah, she's been on a roll the last couple of years.
Yeah, she reported that Mayor Durkin's office had told her that the city is not going to move forward with fingerprinting the homeless or any other kind of biometric scans of the homeless in order for those homeless folks to obtain shelter and other services.
Yeah.
Durkin had proposed doing this, and the Human Services Department, head of the Human Services Department, Jason Johnson, had asked folks under him in the department to do a little study and to come up with a recommendation as to whether or not fingerprinting would be a good idea or some other biometric scan for providing services to the homeless. And Erica Barnett got a hold of the original memo that was drafted by Human Services Department employees saying that they were very much against doing any kind of fingerprinting because they thought it would, in particular, exclude undocumented folks from obtaining services, as well as people who have major psychiatric disorders, particularly folks who are paranoid or have a schizophrenic
or who've
illness.
Just had a bad experience with Seattle's bureaucracy.
Yeah, or who have been through the criminal justice system. Mm-hmm. Fingerprinting can be triggering and can turn them away from services before they've even had a chance to see what services are available to them. So they recommended strongly in their original memo. And then Mayor Durkin's office this week released the final memo to Erica Barnett. And she said that in the final memo appeared to have been massaged by folks perhaps in Jason Johnson's office or directly under him to remove a lot of those concerns from the memo that were originally in the first draft.
That's all you need to know about HSD.
Yeah, so I thought that was very, very interesting. And that one of the recommendations in the early memo and that she thought was very important is that Human Services Department employees had recommended a number of things to do instead of biometric scanning or digital IDs. And one of the recommendations was that they remove any kind of ID identification check for mm-hmm. providing services, that you just provide services to all comers. If they need it, give it to them. I thought that was a very interesting idea. And that if you ask yourself, what are these services for? Services are for people who need them. They're not really for checking IDs at the door.
And HSD has been kind of on a warpath against emergency shelters the last couple of years. And that fits that definition. It's, you know, low bar emergency shelters are meant to get people off the street and out of the cold. Mm-hmm. That's it.
Right. And you really have to ask, what is the checking the IDs really for? It's really for the city to keep track of and to build their database, this sort of data-based delivery of services that the city has been on a warpath to provide. Statistics about are we hitting our goals? Are we making progress? You know, and who is that really for? That's really for businesses and wealthy people and upper middle class folks who doubt that the government can do any kind of good when it comes to helping homeless people. And is the city really making any progress, et cetera, et cetera?
Yeah, and the city has a long track record going back at least to Ed Murray's administration of being pretty dishonest in those statistics in terms of their definitions and some of the things you have to read into it.
Yeah. So I guess the question is then, you know, what do you err on the side of we have to collect our good statistics, or do you err on the side of we need to really provide these services to all comers so that we do make some real progress in getting people the help they need and getting them off the street?
How about saving lives? That would be a good goal too.
Yeah, saving lives is a good goal. Getting people into permanent housing is a good goal, or getting them the mental health services that they need, or getting convicted felons the housing and the food and the shelter that they can't get because When they go to apply for an apartment, their application is run through a background check and they're denied.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, moving on, Tim Iman is getting a little heat this week.
Yeah, this week, Judge James Dixon ruled that Tim Iman has raised $776,000 from supporters of his initiatives over the past 7 years, since 2012, but has not filed a single report to the Washington Public Disclosure Commission, as he would be required. Tim Iman is 2,706 days late in registering as a political committee, according to the judge, and Iman has accumulated 476 years. He's 476 years late in filing monthly campaign finance reports. This means that Iman could be on the hook for penalties of up to $5 million. Judge Dixon ruled almost...
You're smiling as you say this.
Well, for those of us who have seen the damage that his initiatives have done to transportation services and to the state budget and to local budgets.
Yeah, and we're still waiting to find out whether I-976 will have to take effect or not, because that will decimate it further.
Yeah, will decimate them further. Judge Dixon ruled almost 2 years ago that Iman is in contempt of court for not producing his financial records for the court to examine. Those fines for his contempt of court add up to over $230,000. So those would be on top of the $5 million the maximum penalties are applied. Now, the judge didn't rule on separate charges that Iman is using campaign contributions to enrich himself by paying his personal expenses out of campaign funds and concealing the source of other political contributions. Those charges will be heard in a separate trial scheduled for July. So Iman's legal troubles are far from over.
All right.
Poor guy.
Yeah, and you know, in July, that July trial is going to start just before he is up for, I believe it's the Republican primary for governorship.
Yeah, he is running for governor now, mm-hmm. which the Republican field is pretty weak, so he might just make it because he has name ID. You know. And, you know, you can supplement his campaign posters with the wanted posters in different post offices.
There you go. Basically, all recognized.
I shouldn't laugh because, you know, I mean, he is probably going through a pretty bad time right now, but hey.
Yeah, he is.
You know,
I actually messaged back and forth with him yesterday.
Yeah, if you do this kind of work, you have to follow the rules, essentially what the judge is saying. And he did not do that. And I think that's. Says something about his character.
Well, yeah, and he's a con man. He always has been. And so he's going to try and get away with as much as he can. Mm-hmm. And I think he's coming to the end of, after 20 years, he's coming to the end of the road on that.
Yeah.
Oh, we'll see.
Yeah.
Those roads tend to go on a little longer than
yeah, the destination is always farther away than you think.
Yeah, you just get over that hill and you see, oh, it goes on for miles and miles. All right. Earlier this week, a very spirited protest in front of Chase Bank in Seattle that got some national attention.
Yeah, down on 2nd Avenue, and it was mostly First Nations people from Canada opposing Chase's investment in pipeline, particularly in a pipeline in B.C., but in the energy sector in general, related to climate change, they objected to it. So they erected a teepee in the middle of 2nd Avenue and Union. And it actually took SPD several hours to get them out of there. So it was mostly covered as a traffic nuisance. But they had a similar protest, I believe, in front of, what was it? It was another bank. Oh, Wells Fargo. Downtown about a year ago, so I'm glad they're coming back.
Yeah, and they've been working with some environmental groups, like 350 Seattle has been working with them, and Extinction Rebellion Seattle, and Defenders of the Salish Sea. So, you know, if you want to get involved in some of these and find out what future actions and upcoming actions are, you can check out meetings with some of those organizations.
Yep.
All right. So that takes us then on to our state legislature, which has been busy.
Yeah, has been busy with bills. Tuesday, February 11th was the last day for bills to pass out of their committees of origin. And then Wednesday, February 19th, that's this week, past week, was the deadline for bills to pass their house of origin, the House or the Senate, and move to the other house to be considered. There were a number of bills that did make it. One bill that's gotten a lot of press locally, House Bill 2907, actually died in the House. That's the bill that would have allowed King County to impose a 0.1% to 0.2% payroll tax on wealthy businesses to fund affordable housing and homelessness services. Many local politicians around this area were pushing to include an amendment that preempts the city of Seattle's ability to charge its own tax. They were working on behalf of large businesses like Amazon, Microsoft, and others. But House Bill 2907, although it died in the House this week, it is not completely dead yet. Nicole Macri, who proposed House Bill 2907, resurrected it with a new bill number. It's now House Bill 2948, and she attached a budgetary provision, which means that the bill now has more time to be considered in the House before it can be called completely dead. But we will see if it makes it further this year.
Yeah, and I was amused that one of her colleagues in the 43rd District, Frank Chopp, got a lot of positive attention he hadn't really earned by coming out and saying, well, I would never have co-sponsored 2907 if it had a preemption clause in it. He didn't say that he would vote against the preemption clause, let alone that he would support the bill, let alone that he would lobby his colleagues. He's no longer the leader.
The House Speaker.
The House Speaker. And so, but I'm sure he has some influence among his colleagues. That was not apparent in final vote.
Yeah. Now, some of the bills that did pass, the House passed House Bill 2467, which would require the State Patrol to create a centralized gun background check database for all gun purchases in Washington State. This would replace the piecemeal background checks that gun retailers do now. They have to contact more than 200 different police agencies in Washington State for handgun buyers and folks who want to buy semi-automatic rifles. For people who buy long guns, that would include lever, bolt action rifles, or shotguns, retailers have to contact the FBI. This law would centralize all of that information in one place and make background checks faster, more accurate, and would save a lot of money for police agencies around the state. Similarly, the Senate passed Senate Bill 5434, which bans guns from licensed childcare centers. The bill is now going to move on to the House for consideration. But House Bill 2240, which would have banned high-capacity ammunition, was stopped cold on the House floor when Republicans piled on over 120 amendments. Democrats were forced then to abandon that bill instead of wasting time trying to address 120 different amendments, some of them with just a change of three or four words in the bill. Now, amongst the housing bills that have passed, our Senate Bill 6617, which would lift restrictions on accessory dwelling units statewide, that's mother-in-law apartments or backyard cottages, that passed the Senate and is now headed to the House. House Bill 2343 would reduce the amount of parking that developers are required to provide with new homes. Parking is often cited as an amenity that drives up the cost of multifamily housing developments. More controversially, a Republican-sponsored bill to exempt some new developments from the State Environmental Policy Act, that's SEPA, that's House Bill 2673, that passed the House and is scheduled for a public hearing in the Senate's Housing Committee this coming Wednesday. Now, among the environmental bills being considered, three have passed the Senate and are now in the House committees. That includes Senate Bill 6213, which would ban most polystyrene food containers statewide, although meat and fish trays and some packaging for vegetables and eggs would not be banned, although I would argue those should be banned.
Yes.
Yeah. Senate Bill 5323 would require retailers to charge 8 cents for a large paper or plastic bag at checkout, and that would be statewide, not just here in the city of Seattle. And Senate Bill 6278 would block the construction of water bottling plants in Washington State by placing a prohibition on selling water rights for bottling. Now, on the criminal justice front, Senate Bill 5291 passed the Senate. This bill would provide a community service option with supervision instead of jail time for low-risk offenders who have minor children at home. This bill is meant to end the generational transfer of poverty and crime in some families. You often see this even in low-level criminal cases where a parent goes to jail, they have minor children at home, the kids grow up in a chaotic environment, and they turn to crime as they get older as well. So this is meant to end that that problem. Senate Bill 6112 also passed the Senate and is on its way to the House. It would restrict the practice of placing juvenile offenders in solitary confinement. An estimated—
That's a good idea.
Oh, yeah. An estimated 62%, or almost two-thirds, of juvenile offenders spend at least some time in solitary confinement, while 50% of juveniles who are held in solitary confinement attempt suicide. This bill seeks to mostly end this barbaric practice.
At least
for kids under 18.
Those statistics are horrific.
Yeah.
They really are.
They really are. And finally is Senate Bill 6442 to ban the operation of privately run prisons in the state of Washington. That passed the Senate and is also on its way to the House. Very good news there.
Yes. I'm a little hung up on the exemptions to the polystyrene ban. Since, you know, the whole point of it is to get materials that don't degrade out of landfills and out of the streams. And honestly, I don't understand the exemptions because salmon and wildlife don't really care what the original packaging
was
for.
We have not needed polystyrene to package meats, vegetables, and eggs for I don't know how many generations. And there are recent developments, and I don't understand why you exempt them.
Well, you'd exempt them because that industry has really good lobbyists.
Has a lot of power.
Exactly.
That's true.
Exactly.
So, but I have to say with that bill, you know, it's one step at a time. Take the first step where you ban most of it and then come back and go for that, for the second ban.
Yeah. Get rid of the fish farms while they're at it.
Yeah. That would be nice. That would be really nice.
All right. So anything else for the legislature?
Nope.
I don't think so.
Let's move on.
All right. Then that's going to take us into national.
Woohoo.
Okay. Starting.
Well, why don't I start with the Democratic debate on Wednesday night for Nevada?
Okay.
Yeah.
Since that will probably inform our discussion. The primary ballots have arrived for most people here. People don't have to vote for another 17 days. So it's a week after Super Tuesday. And I would expect several candidates, and including at least one major candidate, to drop out after Super Tuesday. Amy Klobuchar, for example, does not have very good funding to carry her past for Super Tuesday at this point. So unless she does surprisingly well, I don't expect that she will continue. That's just a prediction. But, you know, it's going to make a difference in terms of what choices we have and what those choices will mean. The Democratic debate, I thought, was remarkable on Wednesday night. I mean, it was basically a WWE match where everybody was going after everybody. But the person who dominated the debate, really, was Elizabeth Warren. And that's a landmark because the conventional wisdom in political campaigns has been, if you have a woman candidate, you know, don't let her appear angry. That will be off-putting to people. People can't stand an angry bitch, et cetera, et cetera. And it's a very fine line you have to walk between being assertive and appearing off-putting. Hillary Clinton tried that 4 years ago and did not do very well. Didn't do very well in 2008 either. But Warren was extremely regressive all the way through the debate and got a lot of positive press for it. So
aggressive,
you mean?
Yeah, assertive.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
And you know, I think that's a landmark. It's also a landmark when the two women on the stage had the most speaking time of any of the candidates. So those were all good signs, I thought.
And I noticed, too, that debate got higher ratings than previous debates, probably because we're coming closer to the time when people have to make a decision and vote. So more people are tuning in and want to see.
Yeah.
Plus, we've eliminated a whole bunch of candidates.
It set an all-time record for presidential primary debates in terms of viewership.
Well, and it was engaging the whole way through. So you got a lot of times you'll have people that will watch a couple minutes and, you know, then flip the channel. So this one kept you glued.
But if, you know, if you want to see what happens to the candidate that got hit over the head with a chair, you have to stay tuned.
Yeah. Yeah. So are you recommending that people go back and watch it if they haven't watched any debates?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you're not going to learn a lot about policy. You're going, except you learn that Mike Bloomberg has none.
Which is good to know.
Yes, it's good to know. If I hear Joe Biden say one more time, I'm the only one on the stage who's older than Methuselah, I'm the only one on the stage who invented fire, et cetera, I don't know what I'll do. it's an annoying habit he has, and he's also very defensive. Klobuchar is also very defensive, which doesn't help her. I think neither Bloomberg nor Biden had a particularly good night, and Klobuchar and Buttigieg benefit from that.
Yeah, but has Biden had any good nights? That's the question here. And I think that's an issue, too, that I try to remind people of. You know, Biden's run for president before, and he's never gotten very far, because when it comes to speaking, when it comes to elucidating what he stands for, he's just not very good at that. And I don't think it's a function of his age, necessarily.
No,
I think it's just who he is.
He has this reputation of being affable and easy to get along with and so forth.
A nice guy.
He does not project that when he speaks at all.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, and when he gets angry, which he did several times Wednesday night, it's like, okay, this is when the consultants told Joe to get angry. He's going to try and act angry now. it just doesn't work.
Yeah.
So yes, but it was an interesting debate.
So let's talk too, because I know we got ballots and we got our voters pamphlets this week for our upcoming primary, which is early March.
Yes, and again, March I would 12th, remind people that you don't have to vote until after Super Tuesday on March 5th, which will I think have a clarifying effect on the field. But I think like a lot of progressives, I've been kind of torn between Sanders and Warren in terms of, you know, policy preferences, and they're the two truly progressive people running. And the fact that you have two truly progressive people to choose from is also a first in a primary. There's the question of, what are the benefits and non-benefits of each? On Sanders' side, he has a very, very consistent and clear ideology that appeals to a lot of people, obviously. He has an incredibly enthusiastic base, which will help with turnout. The concerns, of course, center largely around electability. Bernie's true supporters will insist that he's the only one who can beat Trump. I think either of them can beat Trump, but that's just me. His health, because not necessarily the heart attack. I mean, he's incredibly robust and strong right now, and he shows that every day with all of his different campaign stops. But, you know, he's going to be 82 by 2024. My father got a sudden cancer and died at 79. My mother got a serious cancer and barely survived at 77. So, you know, my personal experience with that anyway is he's getting into the age where things can happen. And that brings me to my other concern about Sanders is, yes, he's building a movement, but does it survive if he's not there? We saw this once before with Jesse Jackson in the late 80s, the Rainbow Coalition. He tried to build a movement that would last past him. It did in a few places, including Seattle. It was quite vibrant into the 90s, but it really petered out mostly nationally and was never an electoral force again. So that is... I hope there's some organizing going on amongst all the Sanders supporters to make sure that the movement is independent of Sanders. It's just supporting him.
And I think we see that when we see people within the Sanders camp talk about who he's going to announce as his running mate. They're really hoping for somebody young, vibrant, who is on the national stage, who can carry the movement along. And I've heard a lot of them say that their ideal candidate would be Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez.
Yeah. Well, she's not old enough yet.
Yeah.
She will be. It'll happen. And I'll bet she runs for president, too.
Yeah.
Other concerns I have about Sanders include how he can get his agenda through Congress. I think Warren has laid out a pretty good plan, both for executive actions that don't need congressional approval. They both have good track records of collaborating across the aisle in Congress. You know, Russia is not stupid. They're trying to help the Sanders campaign because it feeds their goal.
Well, they see it as divisive.
Yes, exactly. It feeds their goal of maximum divisiveness. And is that really what we need right now?
Well,
they're not stupid. They know that very well could happen with the Sanders campaign.
Yeah, I also think that Russia feels that, or I should say, Putin and his supporters feel that Sanders probably couldn't win against Trump.
Yeah.
Whereas I think that it's the reverse, actually. I think that Trump has been so divisive and that he has radicalized a lot of people who are now supporting Sanders in the primary, and which is why Sanders has done so well so far.
Or who haven't felt in the past like they had the candidate they could vote for.
Yeah.
At least in the major parties.
Yeah. So I think, you know, for me, when I talk about personally who I would support as the most progressive candidate, I feel Sanders just noses ahead of Warren for a lot of different reasons, particularly his history. And I would say
that, too, in terms of my ideology.
That he has a lot of experience in Congress, more experience than Warren does, and that he has worked with a lot of folks in the Democratic Party in Congress. So he is not as divisive a candidate as the media likes to portray him as. I think it's the media.
Unfortunately, we're stuck with that media through the election.
Yeah, I think it's the media trying to over-dramatize issues among the candidates in the Democratic Party.
They want ratings.
There is definitely a split between the progressive wing of the Democratic Party and the more conservative wing of the Democratic Party. And we see that with Sanders and Warren versus Buttigieg and Biden.
Yeah.
And Klobuchar on
and
the other side. Yeah, and Bloomberg. So that's definitely there. But in terms of Sanders versus Warren, I don't see that so much. But I do see the difference in experience there.
I do have a concern that Sanders supporters, if Warren got the nomination, might not support her, which would be unfortunate.
Which would be terrible, I think.
Yeah. I think Sanders has a better chance of carrying the Warren supporters than vice versa.
Yeah, personally, for me, I would vote for either one of them. I think they're both great candidates. I think they could both do a great job.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, I'm just nosing towards Bernie.
I'm nosing toward Warren, although I reserve the right to change my mind between now and the 10th or 12th. But, you know, I think it's important to elect a woman president. We need that precedent.
I feel that, too. That's why Warren is so close in my mind with Sanders. I could vote for either one of them for very good reasons.
And I think she has a more accessible life story than Sanders does. And that makes a difference as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there are a lot of folks in the Democratic Party who would prefer to support a woman than a white guy, than an aging white guy. So there's that as well. But, again, Sanders has shown a lot of support for issues that matter to people of color and to women. So I support him for that.
So we're not telling you how to vote. We're just telling you what we're thinking about it.
We're just kind of telling you how we would if we were personally going to the polls. And, of course, we're just pointing out, too, some of the issues that people on the progressive left have with different candidates.
Yeah. And I do think with Warren, there's also the downside that there's a number of voters who are still pretty misogynist. Would not vote for her because she's a woman.
That's unfortunate.
Yeah.
And that's a definite.
I've seen a lot of people taking Warren to task for having been a Republican when she was younger. And I have to say, look, if you're going to close out people who change and change their mind, you're going to have to close out a whole lot of members of your own party. So there are a lot of people in the Democratic Party who have been further to the right or further to the left and are now pretty solid Democrats. So, you know, you got to leave the door open for people to change.
And I would also say she grew up in Oklahoma where the Democratic Party really doesn't exist.
Yeah.
So, you know, that is not a mark against her in my mind.
Yeah.
And to pick if either of them were to win, if they were to pick the other as their running mate, I really think they could clean up the field.
Yeah, I think so, too.
Yeah, I agree.
And I just want to clarify, it's March 10th.
10th. Okay.
10th. So
I will burn that into my mind.
Okay. And more importantly, everyone listening, burning that into their minds.
Yes.
That's a lot more votes.
Yeah. Yeah. So you can wait for Super Tuesday to fill out your ballot. You can fill out your ballot now. It's up to you. Do your own homework, do your own research, and make up your own mind.
And send it in.
And then send it in. But vote.
Yes.
Yeah. And yeah. Always encourage others to vote, too.
Yeah. And I would say the bottom line in all of this is getting Trump out of office. I mean, we saw that this week where it's headed in terms of Trump wanting to basically be an authoritarian dictator. Mm-hmm. And reserve all powers to himself. I'm not confident if he gets a second term that we'll have an election in 2024. He has moved the goalposts so much in terms of presidential power in the last 4 years that if he's unfettered, if he gets reelected, if the Senate is still in Republican hands, we're in for a world of trouble.
My concern is that the damage that he and his appointees have done to the federal government and the amount of corruption that's being yeah. exposed and will be exposed if he gets a second term will just destroy people's faith in what government can do and will destroy any support people have for the federal government.
Yeah, and of course that's one of Russia's goals as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
This year, our democracy really is at stake. So the choices are important, and it's important to get involved mm-hmm. because it will affect you personally, I promise.
So any specifics that happened this week with the Trump administration that indicate that things are continuing
only
to get
on
worse?
Days that end in Y.
Yeah, that's all of them.
Yeah.
Mike's over here counting on his fingers. Like, yeah, that's all of them.
Well, we had...
Would you like to share some of those?
Sure. Well, we had, I believe, 11 different pardons and commutations this week, most of which were either to Trump's friends or to people who were very well-heeled and or famous and bought their way in.
Or had connections to him in
some
way.
Or had connections, yeah. And as in the case in past pardons that he's issued, it did not go through the usual process of vetting in the White House. There's a whole office that's supposed to be set up for that that is basically now redundant because he just wakes up, goes to poop on the toilet and decides to tweet something. We saw this week with his interfering in the case of Roger Stone, who was set to be sentenced this week. Did receive a sentence of 3 years for his convictions of 7 felonies. I don't expect he will let those convictions last stand for long unless he wants to wait till after the election.
Wasn't the Justice Department prosecutors initially recommending 15 years in jail?
I believe it was 9 to 12.
9 to 12, okay.
Yeah, it was much more. And, the judge in the case is pretty well regarded in the D.C. District Court. She also oversaw the Manafort case and some of the other corruption cases of the Trump administration, and really doesn't suffer fools lightly, and her opinion reflected that. She really reamed the government, mm-hmm. which was entirely justified.
Yeah, yeah. After Trump pressured the prosecutors to back off their recommendation, and then 4 of them resigned.
And one of them quit entirely from the DOJ.
Mm-hmm,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. And so looking at that list of people that he pardoned, 7 full pardons and 4 commutations. And now the difference is a full pardon is your record is wiped clean. So you don't have that conviction on your record anymore.
And you can vote again.
Yeah. And commutation means that the conviction is changed to a lesser crime with a lighter sentence. So that's the difference. 7 full pardons for people like Rod Blagojevich. Former governor of Illinois.
Most corrupt governor in Illinois history. And that's a very high bar.
Was convicted of selling Barack Obama's vacant Senate seat to the highest bidder. So that's some real corruption there. Blagojevich, I want to point out, had appeared on Donald Trump's TV show, Celebrity Apprentice, and Donald Trump had really liked him. So there you go.
Yep.
Another example is
Corrupt people like each other.
Yeah, another example is Bernard Carrick, who served as Rudy Giuliani's bodyguard and chauffeur. He'd been a police detective, and he was eventually appointed by Giuliani to be police commissioner of New York in 2000. Carrick was eventually convicted of tax fraud and lying about his investments, particularly real estate investments and other offenses. So, of course, yeah. A friend of Rudy Giuliani's gets pardoned.
Yeah, and he was also one of the most incompetent police chiefs in New York City's history, which, again, is a high bar.
Yeah. I think most painful was watching Trump pardon Michael Milken, the junk bond king. Milken contributed to the collapse of the savings and loan industry in the late 1980s and early 1990s. That's a crisis that wiped out approximately one half of the savings and loan banks in the United States over the course of about a decade and a half. And it cost taxpayers $132 billion at minimum, not to mention the folks who lost their savings when their banks failed.
And he was he excelled at the pyramid scheme, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, a man after Trump's own heart, basically, and fellow con person.
Yeah.
And, it was truly
yeah.
appalling. And it sends a bad, bad message to Wall Street at a time when we're still seeing the kind of abuses that led to the Great Recession in 2008.
Yeah. Now, I want to point out, too, that Milken had not even put in an application to be pardoned with the Justice Department. The usual process is the Justice Department has an office that takes applications from people who are requesting a pardon. They draw up a list of recommendations that they forward to the Assistant Attorney General, who then goes down that list, checks their work, and then forwards the final list onto the White House for the president to consider.
Right.
That's the
White House office that's not being used.
Yeah.
Either.
That process was not followed at all by Donald Trump. He just pulled these names out of a hat, mostly as recommendations from friends and other billionaire businessmen who suggested to him who to pardon. Milken's name, for example, was forwarded to him by Sheldon Adelson and another billionaire Republican donor named Nelson Peltz. Those guys were friends of Milken's, and they said, oh, why don't you get our buddy off, you know,
yeah.
Even though he didn't ask for it, we want you to pardon him. And Trump was really quick to say, yes, I'll do it.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe most disturbing thing of the week, and again,
well,
that's a high bar.
Yeah.
Was the series of tweets where Trump was calling himself the chief law enforcement officer.
Oh, yeah.
And that he would happily interfere in Department of Justice criminal cases. And of course, Barr has been doing his bidding in that behalf. This is a guy who, for the last 4 years, has consistently suggested that his political opponents be locked up. That's something authoritarian dictators do. And he has a free road now to do it. And he, the Senate's not going to stop him. The DOJ's not going to stop him. One of the concerns about the Democratic nominee this summer, maybe he'll spend some time in jail. I mean, this is what happens in authoritarian countries.
Yeah.
And he's trying to follow that blueprint.
Yeah. And the pardon process in particular is kind of interesting because it's really not a democratic process, right? I mean, it's literally above the law, and it's a holdover from monarchies, right?
Sure.
The king could pardon whoever he wanted to outside of the law that exists. Usually presidents wait until the last few days of their presidency in order to announce high-level pardons like this. And they often try to make sure that they're careful in following the recommendations of the Justice Department, and then it goes through several levels of vetting before it gets to them in order to make it appear as if it's still part of the criminal justice system. Trump was he very much wanted to ensure that he did not do that, because he wants to point out that, yes, as president, he has these powers that are above the law and the criminal justice
yes.
system. And yes, he can act as a king.
So anybody who's a Trump crony who's violating the law, he'll have your back. That's the message.
Yes, that is the message, is that he has these powers that are extraordinary and are above the criminal justice system and above the legal system, and that no one else in the country has, and he will exercise them and he will use them whenever and wherever he sees fit. And that is his attitude, and that's something that I think we need to take into consideration as the presidential elections come around.
Yeah, and you know, he has also made clear that he'll pardon his friends and colleagues and people who are recommended to him by friends like Giuliani, and he will try and take revenge on anybody who crosses him.
Mm-hmm, exactly. And
we're already seeing that with the fallout from the impeachment inquiry and the people who testified in that.
All right. Mm-hmm. Anything else on that?
Nope.
All right.
No, that was the horror movie part
of the week.
Yeah.
Well, the one coming out of D.C.
Yes.
Also this week, speaking of a horror movie, there was a study from the journal Nature regarding methane.
Yeah, there was a study published this week in the journal Nature. It was researchers at Rochester's Department of Earth and Environmental Studies. They were looking at atmospheric levels of methane, looking at the different sources of methane, and those different sources of methane around the world produce different methane isotopes. So the researchers thought, if we look at ice cores from Antarctica and from Greenland that go back to the 1700s, we identify those different isotopes of methane, we count the amount of isotopes in the different layers, what will that tell us about the sources of methane today?
Yeah.
So what they
and what's likely to be released into the atmosphere, either from, say, glaciers or permafrost when they melt.
Right. So, mostly they're looking at what are the sources of methane today versus what they were in the 1700s. And what they found is that, yes, while the oil and gas industry argues that most methane nowadays is from natural sources, that no, that was true in the 1700s. It's not true today. What they found is that, yes,
they're working on old data, is what you're saying.
Yeah. What they found is that, yes, there is a lot of methane that comes from things like livestock production for food and from landfills and primarily food waste. But the largest source of atmospheric methane is from the oil and gas industry.
I'm shocked.
They're getting an easy ride nowadays because they assume, and a lot of folks in the political arena have assumed, that oil and gas production accounts for about 40% less methane than it actually does. So this is a really good study, and a really important study for understanding that if we want to cut at emissions of methane into the atmosphere, we have to start with the oil and gas industry.
Yeah, and they're also getting a free ride because they have an army of lobbyists that own D.C.
Yeah.
And other countries, too.
Yeah, and I should point out, too, methane's very, very important because it is 80 times more potent as a greenhouse gas than CO2 or carbon dioxide. And when other folks are saying, well, we got to get our CO2 emissions levels down, yes, that's true, but I think methane emissions are even more important, and particularly in the short term. So when the oil and gas industry saying, oh no, those crazy environmental folks who are protesting our pipelines, we need to get them out of there so that we can export oil and gas, and you know, natural gas is a clean fuel, no, we need to remind them that that is not the case.
Well, I mean, the talking point on the right for the last several years, at least in the U.S., has been any scientists that are part of that crazy radical left, because they come up with answers that they don't like.
Okay.
And I think we need to say no to that.
Yes,
that's just
I agree. I'm pro-science. I'm not voting for Trump.
I am pro-science. I'm not for folks who want to make you doubt science because it doesn't support their agenda.
Exactly.
All right.
Their predetermined agenda.
Mm-hmm.
Moving on to this week's developments regarding the coronavirus.
Yeah, wanted to do a quick update on that. It's kind of gotten crowded out of the news because of all the stuff going on domestically. But, you know, virus is spread without regard to what's going on in American politics. And what we have seen this past week is a sharp uptick in the number of cases and the number of deaths. It's now up to 77,000 cases and about 2,300 deaths. A lot of those are in China, but it's also starting to spread person to person in several other places, which is quite worrisome. Iran apparently has a new cluster of cases, which they had never reported before. Europe is having problems. Japan and South Korea are having problems. And it's probably only a matter of time before the United States does as well. And this is something that is obviously affecting the Chinese economy because a lot of the major cities are on lockdown right now, which makes it hard to produce things for people to get to work, and it makes it hard to export things, and it makes it hard for American companies, for example, or European companies that rely on Chinese labor in their food supply chain. That's going to have an impact.
It's already having an impact on the global economy.
Yeah,
and for that reason,
we're already seeing, you know, the oil market wobbling because of uncertainties about that.
One of the interesting things too about COVID-19, which is one of the names that's
right.
starting to get used for this virus.
That's the specific name. There's coronavirus is a type, and this is the new type. It's like the seventh known one. SARS was an earlier one.
Yeah.
So it's similar to SARS, but it spreads much more easily. That's the worry.
Yeah. So what they're saying, scientists this week said that they know more about how it spreads, that it spreads through your respiratory droplets. Those droplets tend to be too heavy to float in the air. However, if you're within about 6 feet of someone who is infected, then you could inhale the virus from them. And unfortunately, because the world is a more crowded place now, cities are much more crowded.
Especially in East Asia.
Buses and subways are more crowded. Being within 6 feet of somebody who has a virus like that is much more common than it used to be.
Yes, and it could be three people away. You'd never know.
Yeah.
The other interesting thing that came out this week was the length of time that the virus can survive on surfaces and spread that way, up to 9 days, which is problematic.
Yeah, which makes it much harder for you to keep from getting it. I think the most important thing that people need to know is that wearing a mask doesn't really protect you. What protects you is washing your hands and, as I said, trying to stay out of super crowded situations if you can.
Yeah. I think masks are helpful in crowded situations or if you're already immunocompromised.
Well, or if you are sick and you don't want to spread it, wearing a mask is a really good idea. However, if you haven't gotten sick yet, masks don't provide a whole lot of protection for it. Now, the death rate, I think, is kind of important. For an average flu bug, the death rate is usually far less than 1% of the people who get the illness. In this case, it looks like the death rate may be 2-3%, which is much higher than the flu.
And is roughly the same as what the 1918 Spanish flu was, which decimated a lot of the world.
So that's why public health agencies are really concerned about COVID-19. Now, in addition, I think it's important to remember, too, the folks who are getting sick in Asia and dying from the disease, seriously ill and dying from the disease, have problems with their lungs. They're either smokers, they're vapors, or they're folks who have pre-existing lung conditions.
Or they're elderly.
Or they're very elderly, who are immunocompromised.
Yeah.
So that's probably why
you're not seeing a lot of kids getting it. Some have, but not many.
That's something to consider, too. So if you are having issues with your lungs, you may want to avoid crowded places.
The other thing that underscores all this is the budget cuts that Trump has made to the CDC and the National Institutes of Health.
That's not helping.
It's not helping the United States response, and it means a lot of the cutting edge research is going on in China and other parts of the world. Mm-hmm. But people are trying to work together and develop the vaccine and all that for this, because public health officials are extremely concerned about the potential for a pandemic.
Mm-hmm. Events.
Okay, now we'll give you something cheerful to do after we've depressed you. This evening, Elizabeth Warren is going to be in town at the Armory, which is the new name for the Seattle Center House. I don't know what consultant came up with the idea that let's do something really warm and inviting for the public. We'll call it the Armory. is bad.
That was its old name, kind of a holdover from when it was a military installation.
Yeah. So that's happening from 6 to 8 o'clock tonight. Get there early because it will be crowded. I guarantee it. And of course, Bernie Sanders had a huge Tacoma Dome rally earlier this week, too. We should mention that. On Tuesday, February 25th, Conor Daugherty is going to be talking at Town Hall on the fight for housing in America. That's $5 at Town Hall, Ethan Senega, downtown. At the same time, upstairs, Susan Feller will be talking on fighting sexual harassment in Silicon Valley, which is probably going to be of interest to a lot of people who work here. That, again, is $5 Town Hall. And then on Wednesday evening at Town Hall, the syndicated columnist E.J. Dionne, a liberal syndicated columnist who has been sounding the alarm on Trump for many years. He's talking about uniting progressives and moderates to save our country, which I think is a pretty good framing at this point. Democrats have to come together, and they're not going to be Trump in November. It's at $5 again at Town Hall. Ethan Senega, downtown, 7:30, Wednesday night.
All right. Well, fingers crossed that we get you both back next week.
I'm planning on being here.
All right.
Even if I have to take the bus before the bus before the bus I'm supposed to take.
Sounds like a plan.
I currently do not have any surgeries scheduled.
All right.